Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today we're going to be talking about recent releases by Interpol, Death Cab for Cutie, Mitski, and Boxing. And my sparring partner in this week's episode is our old friend Ian Cohen, who of course you know from many, many outlets, including Pitchfork, Stereo Gum, Spin, and the Celebration Rock Podcast. He's been on this show many times. We refer to him as our Alec Baldwin. We always like to have Ian on the show. It's always fun to talk about music with him. And we dug into these records. You know, we have two legacy bands, and we have two sort of up-and-coming indie acts. And it was fun to get into it with Ian. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about our sponsor for this week, and it is our friends at Indeed.com. When you're hiring, you don't want to waste time sorting through dozens of irrelevant resumes. You want an efficient way to get to a short list of qualified candidates. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions based on your job requirements. Then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. Discover why 3 million businesses are using Indeed for hiring. Post a job today at Indeed.com/hire. Search for greatness. Search Indeed. Yes, so maybe you are, you know, a very well-respected music editor and you're looking for a new job because you've just left your longtime place of employment. You know, or maybe you're looking for an editor of some sort.
We're hiring a DJ here at the radio station. We're going to use Indeed.
Maybe you want a new podcast host for your favorite
or
music
producer.
Producer, because you're sick of the person you have. You want to hire somebody else. This is the place you want to go. So again, when it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You don't need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, and zero in on the qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com. Okay, so yeah, so me and Ian Cohen, we talked about latest records from Interpol, from Death Cab for Cutie, Mitski, and Foxing. We gave our yays or nays on all of those albums, kind of dug into it. And yeah, it was a great, really great conversation. So without further ado, here is me and Ian Cohen talking about a lot of great recent rock records on the Celebration Rock Podcast. So Ian, it's always a pleasure to have you on here talking about, I guess, four big records here, four big rock records. I always feel like it's a special thing when there's like four notable rock records in the space of a couple of weeks. It always feels like a gift.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you want to call big. I mean, I think they're ones that are, I don't know, important and, you know, important in a certain way, but big is relative.
Well, you know, big in our world. We're going to say big in our world. We don't care
there
about the
go.
Outside world.
There we go.
Well, let's cool. get into it. Let's talk about Marauder, the latest record by Interpol. This came out on Friday, August 24th. And I reviewed this record for uprocks.com. I actually wrote a profile of the band. I interviewed all three band members talking about the record. And I like this record. I have to say that I'm somewhat of a sucker for late period Interpol records. Okay, let's walk through this. Okay, so Interpol, it's their first record in 4 years since 2014's El Pintor. They worked with Dave Friedman, a very notable indie rock producer, most famous probably for working with the Flaming Lips, but he's worked with a number of other bands. This record was recorded mostly live to tape. I know when I interviewed the band members, they talked about how raw they felt the record sounded. They appreciated the, I guess, lack of studio slickness compared to other Interpol records. The single off this record is called The Rover, and I thought it was one of the best singles that they've put out, certainly this decade, I think in a very long time. Really good song. You know, the lyrics are, of course, are ridiculous, and I'm sure we'll get into, you know, some of our favorite Paul Banks quotes from this record. But, you know, when I was writing about this record, I found myself appreciating Interpol as survivors. You know, because, you know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about that early 2000s class of New York City bands. And, of course, that's headlined by the Strokes. But a lot of those bands now are in a state of flux. You know, the Strokes certainly are in that realm. You know, TV on the Radio is active, but it's unclear exactly where they're at right now. Yeah, that's true of. The National, I guess, are technically of this generation, although I don't really put them in that class. They seem like they're more like mid or late. Interpol, to me, in a way, they feel like the most enduring band of that class. And I just found myself sort of appreciating their Interpol-ness on this record. The comparison I made in my story was talking about how, like, when U2 put out All That You Can't Leave Behind, I feel like that was them sort of saying, okay, this is who we are. We're going to kind of sound like ourselves. We're not really interested in, you know, walking out of lemons anymore or trying to change up our image. We are who we are, and this is what it's going to be. And I feel like that's what Interpol did on this record. And if you go into this record expecting something different, you're going to be disappointed. But if you go in liking Interpol for what they do, their very sort of narrow lane, I think it's a good record. I like this record. And I think that you feel differently, right? You're not as big on this album.
I mean, I for one, also appreciate the Interpol-ness of Interpol. And, you know, the thing about that is, if you go back to, you know, I also wrote about this record. And when you look back at, like, their other records when they went back to Matador, you know, one was called Interpol, like self-titled, and the other was called El Pintor, which is like an anagram or whatever, a rearrangement, whatever that is. It's like they're both self-titled. And I think those albums both did Interpol things. I think it's kind of impossible for Interpol to not do Interpol on this record. But the thing is about on this record, like, all the things that make it, I guess, a more interesting record to talk about compared to the previous ones. Like, Dave Fridman, I mean, even beyond the Flaming Lips, I mean, you know, Tame Impala, MGMT, he did a couple records with Thursday that were awesome. But I think and you think that would be a kind of a strength on strength thing because he gets such a heavy, like, you know, such low end. And on this record, it just sounds like they're stuffed in a trunk. I think it's such a it doesn't have that same sort of, you know, because like when U2 made All That You Can't Leave Behind, it has that very grandiose, you know, Bono saving the world after 9/11 sort of thing, which is actually interesting because like Interpol itself was kind of a very definitive, like, you know, post 9/11 band. They had this like sense of like New York exceptionalism, grandeur, or whatever. I mean, like, you listen to that record and it's, you know, Turn on the Bright Lights, even Antics to a degree, it's still like being, you know, like hearing Interpol for the first time, having those, like, I mean, I live in Philadelphia. I'd be in New York a lot in the early 2000s, and just being young, full of shit, completely having an inflated sense of self, and probably also doing a lot of drugs. That's the Interpol I get. And there's just this sense of this grandiosity to Interpol that is enhanced by their ridiculousness, I think. And I just don't get that from this record. This seems like Interpol trying to make like a garage band. Like, to me, it sounds like if they looked and if they kind of looked like the Strokes or presented like the Strokes, like, this is what it would be, which you know, and that kind of takes away the entire point of Interpol to me. The lyrics are still very Paul Banksian. You know, he's always been way more funny than he's been given credit for. I think there's a self-awareness to his songwriting that is often overlooked. And, you know, people just kind of see him as this kind of Anthony Kiedis character where you can just kind of make fun of him just by quoting him. But I just don't get the same sense of, like, that grandeur, you know, that you get from Interpol. It just seems like a good, it's like a not bad record, but that doesn't quite mean it's great. You know, it's the least bad of the recent Interpol records.
You know, those records that, you know, that thing that you were talking about, sort of the lack of grandeur on the new record, which, you know, is very much a part of Turn on the Bright Lights when people talk about that record, how big it sounds and how lush it is. I kind of like the grittiness of the last two albums. They sound like a band that kind of went back to basics. It's like three guys playing in a room. You hear them playing off of each other. I found myself really appreciating just Interpol as a live band, which I think has been something that has probably kept them alive. Because as much as they're regarded as being this fashion plate rock group that was very much, you know, like on magazine covers and seems to be sort of the epitome of, you know, New York City trendiness in the early 2000s, I think the reason why they've survived, partly anyway, is that they seem like they're a really good live band. You know, they're a good touring band, and getting that element into the records, I think, is appealing to me. It's something I really responded to listening to Marauder. I want to just get back to Paul Banks for a moment. I don't know, like, do you have a favorite lyric on this record? I was just thinking of that song, The Rover, where he talks about, I've been holding these pyros till they could fly, open up and enlighten again, enjoy the skyline. It's an incremental... Oh, the word got cut off there. But, you know, that's one thing in there. I have no idea what the hell he's talking about in that lyric. He kind of has like a Yoda-like cadence to a lot of his sentences, where he kind of starts in the middle of the sentence and then puts it in the beginning and then the end. Yeah, like you say, there is something maybe self-aware about that at some point. Like, he knows he's speaking sort of Interpolese, and maybe, you know, he knows people are going to expect that kind of thing. Were there any lyrics for you that stood out on the record in that regard?
Well, from The Rover, I can keep you an artwork, the fluid kind, which, like, you know, is exactly the kind of thing you're talking about with that, like, Paul Banksian syntax, where it's like, if you glance at it from a distance, it's, you know, it's got that same sense of, like, sinister, like, druggy, sexy, like, you know, New York City thing to it. And then when you, like, focus really, really close, it's just the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard. And I mean, that's like the case with all, like, especially like Obstacle 2 or whatever. But I can't recall the exact song that it comes from, but like, there's one line where I believe he says, like, rock and roll, bitch, I'm into it. Which, I mean, like, you want to talk about, like, Paul Banks and Interpol just really owning the we are in our own orbit. We don't give a shit anymore. Like, this is what we do. And I think that is the one thing that I picked up on this record that made me really, really, really want to like it as much as you do. Because I think when Meet Me in the Bathroom came out, like, I have no idea what someone currently in their early 20s thinks of it. But I think a lot of people our age, and maybe the people who listen to this show, that book really appealed to us, not just because it reminds us of our earlier days or whatever, or just, you know, experiencing these bands for the first time. But Interpol, their image and their whole sort of being is such at odds with what one would consider to be, you know, the indie sort of zeitgeist right now. I mean, you think about, like, you read those stories and you think, like, man, these bands, Carlos D would not last a second today, man. Can you just imagine if, like, and also I think the idea of, like, these guys getting back to basics, I don't think there ever really was a basics. I did an oral history with the band, including Carlos D, back in 2012 for the 10-year Bright Lights reissue. And it's like, they had these big grandiose plans, like, from the get-go, like, from the start. It was like them in a room, like thinking about, like, how to be the most, like, audacious, like, band in New York possible.
Right.
You know, wearing suits instead of that, you know, the kind of Strokes thing that was going on. They took themselves very seriously. And the idea of them, like, going back, like, Interpol, to me, there is no basics. You know, they were always this. It was like whenever you would hear, like, a Smash record where Billy Corgan said, yeah, we're going to get back to basics. Like, no, that was never the case. You guys were always tryhards, and you guys were always, like, going for the most ridiculous stuff possible. And so this record actually makes me somewhat nostalgic, not for Bright Lights, but for Our Love to Admire, because that was really them, in my estimation, self-actualizing as this, like, I don't know, like, more like a Killers or Duran Duran, like, sort of fashion plate, big time major label band.
Right.
And, like, you know, No I and Threesome, the Heinrich Manoeuvre, like, all these songs that are just, like, objectively ridiculous. And but the thing is, at that time, I don't know if they were quite aware. I don't think they had quite the ownership of that. So it necessarily became time to turn on them. You
well,
know?
And you hit on this. I think part of the appeal of that generation when people look back on it is that the bands that back then had a very sort of distinct, they had distinct personas that came yeah. with, you know, how they looked, how they sounded. You know, the Strokes, you know, they didn't wear suits, but they wore leather jackets. They wore, like, the jeans and, like, the cool vintage T-shirts. Like, they had their own costume, too. And, like, the Yeah had a costume. And the Interpol had a costume. And they all had an aesthetic. And, you know, even great bands now, you know, it's just people walking in off the street and going on stage. Like, the visual component with bands now is not what it was at that time. It seems like there's always a pendulum swing with that sort of thing where, you know, you go through a period where, like in the 90s, you had grunge bands, and I guess you could argue that they wore a costume too, but it was definitely about dressing down. And then there seemed to be this thing about, like, no, it's cool to dress up. It's cool to, again, have this sort of visual aesthetic to what you're doing. And and then that kind of fell out of favor after those bands sort of came and went. But, yeah, I mean, with Marauder, I guess I just appreciate that the thing that you could criticize Interpol for, which is the fact that they don't change and that they're very sort of narrow sonically, to me is like a big part of their appeal. Like, they do something that I feel like is very specific to them. And when I want that very specific thing, I know I can listen to Interpol and still get it. And I think they still deliver it pretty well. Like, I don't think Marauder is the second coming of Turn on the Bright Lights, but I think it's like a pretty good late period Interpol record. Certainly much better than I was expecting. This one and El Pintor both. I enjoyed both of these records. So I'm glad they're still doing
I'm glad they exist. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I won't begrudge them for existing. If they give me like two or three songs that give me that Interpol buzz, you know, per record, like this one does, you know what? Keep going, man. Like, I just I love the fact that they could possibly, like, at any festival where there's going to be a bunch of bands that I probably don't give a shit about, like, I appreciate that Interpol is still around to appeal to the olds, you know?
Right. Or to younger people that are looking for their version of, like, The Cure or Depeche Mode. I mean, because the Interpol is aging into that now, into, like, the legacy band that has a couple of songs that everyone who's into indie rock knows. So if you are at like Riot Fest or something and Interpol's there, it's like, oh, I'm kind of drunk. I'm going to go see Interpol and I'll remember Obstacle 1 or whatever. Well, let's go to another legacy band that recently put out a new record, and that is Death Cab for Cutie. Their new record is called Thank You for Today. And, you know, I'm gonna preface this conversation with a confession on my part. I have never cared about this band at all. And that's not a value judgment one way or the other. I've listened to their records. I've, you know, read about them. You know, I know people like you who hold them in fairly high regard. But to me, whenever I've listened to their records, they've always seemed like a nice indie rock band, but nothing really more than that. I think I spent a lot of time in bars in northeastern Wisconsin in the early 2000s instead of watching The OC. So that may have also affected how I feel here. I feel like I maybe missed the zeitgeist with this band a little bit. So I'm going to defer to you here. I want you to make the case for Death Cab for Cutie and also talk about this new record. And then I'll withhold my opinion on it until you have your say.
All right. Well, you know, the thing about just about everything that you say that's about like why this new Interpol record appeals to you, that's kind of the case for me with Death Cab. And, you know, as these two records had a pretty similar album cycle, you know, they've come out like a week apart from each other, dropped singles at pretty, you know, similar times, and also fairly. Not, I mean, I think Death Cab's like the bigger band or whatever, but like it occurred to me that, and I had seen the Pixies and Weezer play together recently, and it dawned on me that like these two bands, like Death Cab and Interpol, could probably tour together at some point.
Oh, absolutely.
Even though like they have, as you described, this aesthetic, it could not be more different. You know, and the thing is, like, Interpol is also on the OC, I'm pretty sure. But
oh, I'm sure they were.
they're not quite as like linked to that era as Death Cab is. Now, Death Cab, I will admit fully that if I was not in my early college, post-college years when those Death Cab albums were new, you know what? I might not be as into them as I am now. On the other hand, though, like, you can't account for this. And when you look back at like Death Cab, I think the thing that really contrasts with Interpol is that they really change from record to record. Like, in the beginning, and I think you know recently, Something About Airplanes turned 20. You know, they started out as a band that could be seen as attached to the Built to Spill, Modest Mouse, Pacific Northwest, almost slowcore sort of sound. You know, if it's an album that could come out today and still be like resonant. It's not Ben Gibbard hadn't quite evolved into, you know, the style of lyricism he's known for now. And then like, which I think we're going to talk about this record later in this episode, but that to me just is it's the kind of record I love so much, where it's a band that has this kind of small sort of, you know, they're just kind of chugging along aesthetic. They do what they do, and they just decide to like blow it up. It's like, we're gonna go for it all on this one. And then, you know, Plans also is for a major label record is just remarkably sad. It's like the record where like instead of like, you know, using your major label budget to like, you know, blow it all on whatever trappings of rock stardom, it's like they just got like made a really, really expensive sounding sad record. And I thought that was so so poignant. And also it's like one of the best albums to listen to in the fall. And when it came out in like late August in Georgia, I mean, I want to make a case for Death Cab for Cutie, but really if I'm talking about that, I'm really just talking about my own life and like the circumstances that brought each of them into my own life. Cause like, you know, when Transatlanticism came out, I had moved to a new city and I was like always visiting like my friends in other cities in which I lived. So like when you play that title track, I mean, it's like you're running across a wheat field, like, you know, about to like embrace somebody. I mean, it's like super duper corny, but like Ben just knows how to hit that spot. And I think if Death Cab were a new band, they would still do that as well. There's a lot of it me type moments that go on.
So the new record, oh, I don't mean to cut you. So were you still emoting about your history with Death Cab for Cutie? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, better that you do cut me off. But the new record.
This new record, because I hear this new record is like a return to form. Wait, Derek, you got something.
I just wanted to interject. One, I ride hard for Death Cab for Cutie, so I'm totally feeling everything Ian's saying. The OC, you know, they used to put out commercially those mixes. And the second OC mix featured both Death Cab and Interpol. So
okay. See, I'm not besmirching Death Cab for the OC connection. I just want to make that clear. Yeah. And but that it's a good stylistic connection here for putting them in this podcast. This is like our own OC playlist episode. So anyway, I'm hearing from Death Cab partisans that the new record is like a return to form. Like, are you of that opinion?
It's a return to form in the sense that, like, the last two records, Codes and Keys and Kintsugi, were I think what we saw with Ben Gibbard was kind of an intent to move away from what they were before. Like, Kintsugi particularly, you know, they Chris Walla left, their longtime producer who produced every record prior to that one. He left the band during the recording. They had brought this guy called – I mean – talk like what a great name for like a super alternative rock producer called Rich Costey. Yes. I mean, like, what a great name. But at that point, they kind of transitioned into more of a band that, you know, would be on K-Rock. Especially Kintsugi, there was more like an arena rock sort of thing going on with them, where it would not be so bizarre to hear them along like played alongside Imagine Dragons or bands like that. And this new record brings it more towards the kind of smaller or sadder of Death Cab for Cutie. No one will ever confuse it with like the Photo album, because the production is so pristine and slick. But you know, the songs that are the songs that do get that Death Cab fix do sort of bring it back to that. But the thing about Ben Gibbard, and this is what distinguishes them from Interpol, is that I very much believe that Paul Banks is the guy on Interpol Records. Like, there isn't, like, I do think that, like, Paul Banks's heart is into it, and the life he talks about on Interpol, it, like, is the Paul Banks you would like to expect. And I think that comes across in interviews and things like that. With Death Cab now, Ben has really turned his life around in a lot of ways. You know, he got married again. He's been sober, as far as I know, for a very long time. And him and the new replacement for Chris Wall like to do marathons. And when Ben sings these very sad songs that are reminiscent of old Death Cab, he is kind of playing a character. And even if he was playing a character on old Death Cab albums, it was like easy to imagine that person being similar to Ben Gibbard. You would imagine he dressed or looked or whatever, or just talked like Ben Gibbard. But now it's more when you listen to Death Cab for Cutie, not for an emotional experience, but like for the craft, you know, he's playing a role, and I think he'll tell you just as much as like, this isn't as divinely or personally inspired as the past Death Cab albums. Like, anytime I hear a new Death Cab for Cutie isn't drawn from Ben Gibbard's personal experience. Like, he's almost trying to guess at what a Death Cab for Cutie fan might want to hear, you know?
Right. So I'm very impressed by the depth of your knowledge and passion here for Death Cab. You clearly are speaking from a personal point of love. You've lived with this band for a long time. They've clearly meant something to you. I can tell Derek is invested in this band as well. And I'm very impressed by that. And I'm impressed by how this band clearly is one of those bands that people, they take into their heart and it means something to them. They care about the albums. They will argue about which albums are the best. They will talk about song lyrics being reflections of their lives. This is my take on the new record. It's aight.
Yeah.
It's aight. It's pretty good. You know, not to invoke U2 again, but sonically, this reminds me of like a 2000s U2 record. Like, it's very kind of keyboard heavy. The guitars are kind of muted. It's melodic. It sounds kind of gauzy. It is, for lack of a better term, very much an easy listening, kind of middle-aged sounding indie rock record. And I don't say any of those things to knock the record. I just feel like that's what it sounds like to me. And if you dropped this album, as well as any other Death Cab album, like, onto my playlist and I just listened to it randomly, I would never have guessed that people love this band so much. I don't really see what is special about this band or what moves people so much. They seem utterly average to me. And I'm willing to admit that I am missing something there. But, you know, because I was investigating their back catalog, getting ready to talk to you. And it's fine. You know, I don't dislike it, but it does not inspire passion in me at all whatsoever. So,
well, I think, on
which
the
is kind
level,
of weird
like
thing to say after, you know, because I'm talking about Interpol. You could very easily say, well, Interpol, why are they better? And I don't know why. I think Turn on the Bright Lights is a record that is a great record, and it meant something to me at a time in my life. I don't know if it's purely about personal experience in this regard. I would say that Interpol maybe has like more of a groove-oriented thing to them. I think as a band, they're more dynamic to hear play live, even if they are sort of narrower sonically.
Well, I'll say this about Death Cab. Death Cab is not a live experience. Like, I mean, I love, like, I've seen it. It's like, oh, cool, you get to hear your favorite songs, but it's like they are not. A lot of that is a testament to like Chris Wallace production.
Right.
I mean, they are not. They are an inessential live band, and you know what? That's fine. I don't rely on Death Cab for the same things I, you know, want out of Interpol. I would say though that if, you know, the new record, it does, it's okay. Like, if I can't think of something to listen to for 30 minutes, yeah, I'll throw that on. Gives me a couple Death Cab songs. Great. Glad they're still going, you know? But I mean, I think we are like, as far as being average, I think Death Cab, even if you're, not a fan of what it is they bring to the table, I think that when you look back on it, there's something so distinct about what they do. It's like, they're so like Ben's voice and the lyric, like, they're so immediately identifiable that it's, you know, you can just say like, okay, well, Death Cab clearly created their own sonic space that, it's easy to see why other people, it might've meant something to them. Like, they just developed a complete aesthetic over time that has evolved. And yeah, I could see why people would absolutely not be down with it at all, because it does speak to a certain early 2000s point of view, be it the OC. And by the way, if you're going to make a Cohen joke, Michael Cohen, like, come on, man. Seth, we've been talking about the OC. Make a Seth Cohen joke.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I wasn't an OC watcher, because that's not a reference that is immediate to me. So, but I will remember that for the future. And again, yeah, regarding Death Cab, you know, I'm totally willing to admit that I'm missing the point, or I'm missing out. But I just don't see it. I do not see the specialness there, but I acknowledge that it means a lot to other people, and that I am missing out because I'm not hearing what other people are hearing. So
I don't wish heartbreak on you, but like, I mean, maybe one day when, you know, when it all goes down and like you're back in that like early 20s mindset, you're going to listen to we have the facts and we're voting yes, and you're just going to be like, you know what, shit, it was just sometimes just bands that could mean something to you, you just don't hit you at the right time.
Somehow I feel like I have enough sad bastard indie rock in my life that probably won't happen, but you know, who knows? I don't leave, you know, life is crazy. That could happen at some point.
I can only conclude that you don't know real pain.
Oh man. it's possible.
Because if you know real pain, no.
The dulcet tones of pain on these. It's like, very, you know, it's very comforting sounding pain on these records.
Real trivia shit.
These are not very ravaged sounding records, I have to say. But anyway, let's move on. Okay, we're going to get back to you in a minute. But before we do, I want to tell you about another one of our sponsors for this week's episode. It is our friends at Blue Apron. Now, Blue Apron, they deliver farm fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's their mission to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And they achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Now, if you're like me, you know, you have a family at home to feed every night, and sometimes it can get really hard at the end of a long day to come up with something you're not just throwing in the microwave. That's when Blue Apron really comes in handy, because they bring you the stuff to your door that you can use to make really cool stuff, like chicken with barbecue sauce and juicy hamburgers and just things that you'd order in a restaurant and pay a lot of money for, but you're getting them at your house, and it's healthier and it's cheaper and it's so yummy. To entice you guys to check out Blue Apron, I'm encouraging you to check out this week's menu, where you can get your first three meals for free if you go to blueapron.com/celebration. Again, check out the menu, pick out your first three meals for free, and you're going to help the podcast. So again, just go to blueapron.com/celebration and get those three free meals. That's Blue Apron, a better way to cook. We've talked about two legacy bands here. Let's talk about two young up-and-comers here. Let's talk about the future here. One of the most acclaimed indie rock records of the year is Be the Cowboy by Mitski. It's her fifth record. And you may know Mitski. You probably first heard about her in 2014. She put out Bury Me at Makeout Creek. That was her breakthrough record. And it was a little bit different than how she sounds now. It's more of like a punk emo sounding record, very hissy and noisy sounding record. 2 years after that, she put out Puberty 2, which was, if Makeout at Breakout Creek was like the Bury Me at Makeout Creek, if that was like the breakthrough on like, you know, indie music sites, Puberty 2 is where she broke through on like sort of big mainstream media sites. That's where everyone started talking about Mitski. It's an excellent record, very diverse sounding record. It's where she first started embracing more pop music, although it was kind of a midpoint between pop and again some of the more kind of punk rock influences that she had on the previous album. Now she's put out Be the Cowboy. And on this record, she's kind of leaving the noisy stuff completely behind. The hissy high end of Bury Me at Makeout Creek has been replaced by a much lusher sound, much more bottom end. You know, it's interesting because she's still working with the same producer that she's always worked with, this guy named Patrick Hyland. But they've really evolved to this sort of, you know, polymath pop sound. There's pop songs, there's disco songs, there's folky songs, there's sort of torchy ballad type songs on Be the Cowboy. For me, and I just want to say, if I haven't made it clear, I really love this record. I think it's definitely one of the best indie rock records of the year. And one of the things that really impresses me about this album is the economy of Mitski's songwriting, that she is able to basically, usually in the space of about two and a half minutes, tell an interesting narrative, deliver two or three really great hooks, and then she's out of there. And the album, I think, has about 14 songs or so, and it's in and out in about a half hour. And yet there's a lot of musical information on the record. There's lots to sink your teeth into. There's lots to explore, and yet, but because of the economy, it never overstays its welcome. It's a very brisk, fun-sounding record. So I really love this record. I'm thinking you're on the same page with this, right? Like, you love the Mitski record as well. I mean, you've written about her in the past. I mean, you reviewed "Bury Me at Makeout Creek" for Pitchfork, so you've been.
That's how you know it was emo.
Exactly. That was in her emo days. She was not getting Best New Music back then, I don't think.
Yeah.
But now she's owning the Best New Music category because she's kind of moved out of that category. But you know, you've seen the evolution that she's gone through. Like, how do you feel about the new record?
You know, the new record. I'm at a point with Mitski where like, she's just got the juice, right? As far as like indie rock or whatever, like, she's at a point, and certain bands or acts reach a certain level when they're very much in their imperial phase, where I cannot picture what a bad Mitski record would even sound like. And to me, that, like, I mean, that maybe that's what keeps me from like completely like being over the moon about it. But I mean, when I listen to this, like, everything you've mentioned, like things like all these like dry ideas about like craft and like, it just becomes exciting in her hands because in some ways it is still rooted in an indie sensibility, maybe not like punk or emo or whatever, but it's not like, say, it's not like an indie pop record the way something like, you know, Carly Rae Jepsen or like Lorde might be. It's still kind of rooted in a more rock sort of idea. I think you're right that the economy of this record really makes it easy to revisit, which is very important because there are a lot of like really great records that have come out this year and years past that are just these totemic monolithic things where you got to like clear off, you know, you got to be like done with things to like listen to it. And Mitski's new record works on, you know, it can be, you can just throw it on the background, but you can also really give it a deep listen, and whatever way you interact with it, it gives. And it does remind me in the past, like how Pixies records would be, you know, where the songs were like super short, but they weren't filler ever. Every song on this record has like an intentionality behind it where it just comes through with such clarity and such purpose that it's really like, you just kind of have to like be wowed at, you know, what's happening here. And also it feels very 2018 in a way that other, other albums that I've heard this year really don't. I mean, I think there's something thoroughly modern about it as well.
Yeah, but it's modern, I think.
It just appeals to all bases.
Right. I mean, I was just going to say, I think you're right, but it's modern in a sonic sense, in a musical sense. It's not kind of capitalizing on the standard narratives that you see with a lot of, you know, sort of critically acclaimed indie rock. And that's one thing, like you were talking before about, it's hard to imagine like a bad Mitski record. I think you mean it's hard to imagine like a Mitski record that wouldn't get great reviews, because she's certainly like a critical darling right now. But I think to her credit, she's not catering to a lot of the sort of standard things that people do when they're trying to get good reviews. There's no sort of obvious Trump angle with this record. There's no sort of, she's not writing the sort of standard narratives that people use, like when publicists send you a record and they want to use the word empowerment in an email, you know, and empowerment in sort of like a marketing sense, not like in a sort of organic sense, you know, knowing that like music critics are going to put that in a headline and that's going to be catnip for them. You know, she's not writing, I mean, you can ascertain political content from any music that you want, but she's definitely writing from a very sort of individual point of view. And she's writing songs as a person who experiences sort of the full spectrum of human experience. You know, like, she's not writing songs in order to be a role model. You know, and she's talked about this in interviews, and I think it's admirable for her to talk about that, especially since you see a lot of artists kind of go the other way where they lean into that, and it can sometimes overwhelm the art a little bit. I feel like Mitski is sort of like a music or an art person first, and she's about sort of the aesthetics of how this record sounds, you know, because again, there's a great variety of just sort of sonic fun to get into on this record, like the song Nobody, how that starts as this sort of indie rock sounding song, and then it explodes into this joyous disco song by the end. Just kind of reveling in the joy of the sound of the record, I think, is what a lot of the appeal of Be the Cowboy is. So it is a critically acclaimed record, but it's not the sort of standard issue critically acclaimed record maybe that you would see in a lot of other places in 2018.
Well, I'll speak to that in the sense of, like, Mitski has been, I think with every artist, there is the component of, like, how they operate in social space, like, you know, what they say on Twitter, like how they come across in interviews. And like, no, and I don't think it's like something, like, I don't think there's like a cynicism about it, but like Mitski is just like, when you watch her do interviews, it's like phenomenal to see someone who like I think gets it. Like, she's the change a lot of people want to see in the world, in the sense of like, she understands that like there is a moral component to music, but it's not like there has to be, like, I think she said in GQ, it's like musicians can't be politicians, you know, it's like there has to be space for, you know, fuck ups and like angry people to a certain degree. And I think that she doesn't try to be like anybody's hero. But at the same time, that aspect makes her so much more of a likable person. Like, I just think she comes across as so thoughtful and genuine, and not in a way where she kind of knows how the narrative, but like isn't trying to feed it. And I mean, you know, I think she just comes across in a way that it comes across as like very genuine. And what, you know, not in the same way of like when you see like, I don't know, like pop artists, like, you know, like Katy Perry, for example, like people who's like, who's, or like Arcade Fire, who just like completely tanked their album rollout because they wanted to, like, you know, be one step ahead of the narrative.
Right.
You know, I think with Mitski, it's like, you know, her work is political in the sense of like being someone who just, as a matter of fact, isn't like the standard white guy that is for so long been like the indie rock default. I think she also comes across to people, and, you know, like, I mean, her breakout album was a Simpsons reference. And I think even on like the new album, the self-doubt comes across, just like wanting someone to remember her name after the show. Like, and being someone who, in her interview, she's kind of expressed like being, you know, kind of like a gifted kid, and wondering like if they're ever going to live up to the expectations they have for themselves or society does. And, you know, that might be more so than like anything like political, like the one thing a lot of younger people are like really grappling with right now. It's like, will we ever, and it's also an internal thing as well. It's like, will we ever live up to the potential? And I think that's like almost the most amazing thing about this record, is that she comes across as like a genuine underdog. Well, maybe not an underdog, but like someone who can genuinely express this self-doubt, even though she's like the most consensusly beloved artist maybe of like 2018 right now. And so it, you know, it really makes her someone that's very easy to root for, which I think is, you know, for better or worse, inextricable from the process of evaluating music.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just get back to the idea of like the cult of personality, which sort of subsumes like a lot of what we talk about with music. I mean, there is the paradox with Mitski, I think, where, you know, when she talks in interviews, you get the sense that she does not want to be put in a box. She doesn't want to be defined. And that translates to her music, in that it's hard to classify exactly what she's doing. I think even calling it indie rock sometimes isn't totally indicative of what she's doing on this record. You know, she wants the space to be an artist where she can kind of do what she wants, explore different areas. And again, I just find myself sort of reveling in the aesthetics of this record. It's a great sounding record. But it's not sort of overtly great sounding. It's not like overly slick. Like you said, it has, I think, there's an element of pop music on this record, but I feel like the indie rock or the indie feeling is still sort of at the core of it. You know, it's kind of a perfect balance between taking some things from pop and some things from indie and putting it together in a way that feels really organic and makes sense. But again, you know, I feel like she goes out of her way to kind of avoid being defined in a certain way, but then again, but then in doing that, that becomes part of her persona, and that kind of feeds into the cult of personality that people have with her. So it's like she avoids it, but then I think she's able to use it in a way that's really smart, where it feeds more into her art maybe than sort of overwhelm it, like with like the way it does with a lot of other people. So she's a very smart person, great artist, great musician. Mitski Be the Cowboy, it's a great record. Let's get to the last album we're going to be talking about. And this is a big album in Ian Cohen world, and a big album in my world too. This is another album I think that we would both put among the very best indie rock records of the year. This is probably your number one indie rock record of the year. Right? I mean,
without a doubt.
Because we're talking about...
It's Near, not even close.
Near My God by Foxing. This record came out, I think it was... Was it August 3rd? Early August?
August 10th. I believe it was August 10th.
And we both wrote about it. We both interviewed a couple of people in the band. So we've both kind of dug in deep with this record. And it's one of those albums... You know, we were talking about the economy of the Mitski record. In a way, Nearer My God is the opposite of that. This album is like the multi-course banquet meal of indie rock records. Sonically, a lot going on. A lot of experimentation, adventurousness, but it's an exciting, thrilling listen. It's the kind of record where a band, they set out to make something great. In, I think both of our interviews, the band members talked about Radiohead being an example for them, and this being compared by the band members themselves to like their OK Computer, you know, like it's kind of, you know, the big sort of operatic, you know, widescreen rock record. And if you're into that kind of thing, I mean, it seems like records like that don't come along all that much. So it's really exciting when a record like that does come along and the band is able to pull it off. For you, like, what is it about this record? You said this is far and away your number one album of the year so far. Why is that the case?
With Radiohead, like, I mean, I think the gold standard for accessible yet artsy rock music. I don't like indie, like they were never indie rock. They were never on an indie label, but like, nonetheless, I think they're kind of a, for guitar based music, like Radiohead being that sort of epitome of, you know, challenging accessible art rock, for lack of a better term. It's, you don't see too many bands actually going for that anymore. I think that there's, and there can be a number of reasons for this. You know, for one, there just isn't the money to do it. Like, you need money to make a great sounding record like this. Even OK Computer, I mean, they were at like Jane Seymour's castle or something like that.
Hey, by the way, should we just give some basic info on Foxing quick? You know, they're a band from St.
Yeah,
Louis.
Yeah, this is their third
record. They're like associated with the punk and emo scene. You know, they put out their first record. What was that, in like 2012, 2013?
So
what was their debut record called?
Okay, so the first record was called The Albatross, and that was released in 2013. It was one of the more distinctive and challenging records to evolve from, like, that first wave of, not the first wave, but like when emo revival became like a term, Foxing emerged as like one of the more challenging and distinctive bands. Like, they were putting in some things on that first record that were, like, some of it sounded like, you know, Sufjan Stevens. Other parts sounded like kind of avant R&B, but they also had, it was just very ambitious and in some ways a little bit grating, in a, like, just because of like the vocals and like the kind of thinness of the sound. And then they made Dealer in 2015, which was a much more, like, it was produced by Matt Bales, who like works with bands like Isis and like, you know, very post-metal. And it was very quiet and kind of very coherent, but like not very loud, and it kind of turned off some people because they were used to that very cathartic sound that Foxing had on the first record. And the thing about Foxing is, despite like what they sounded like on the record, they were always the best live band of that ilk. As much as I love you know, all those bands that come from that wave, you know, Hotel Europe, World is a Beautiful Place. I mean, if you catch those bands on the wrong night, like, it can be a not particularly compelling live experience. Like, and I think that's what's exciting about it. I've seen very transcendent live shows from them. I've seen shows where they're just like, nope, crowd's not into it. They're not feeling it. No matter what time, no matter when I saw Foxing, whether it was a headline show or like the third opening act for Manchester Orchestra or playing with any of those bands, like they always killed it. And that was the thing that came into this record where it's like, they're so good live. How do they capture that on record? And I think with this one, they're just like, yeah, we don't care anymore. We're just going to like, they tried to recreate the live show, but then they just said, you know what? We're just going to put everything we want to do on this one. We're going to put the bagpipes in. We're going to make the 9-minute song. We're going to get Chris Walla to just like put all these layers and textures. And it really stood, it stands out to me because I think a lot of momentum from that whole scene has just been really, there's not a lot of momentum from that scene anymore. I mean, I think at the end of 2006, you know, at the end of like the Hotel Year hasn't made a record in a while. The World Is, like a lot of the band members have left. They're in a bit disarray right now. You know, Pine Grove has their whole scandalous thing going on. Brand New. I mean, there's just that there isn't a lot of momentum from that scene. And like Foxing are somewhat of like a last band standing from that early wave. And, you know, it had been a while since that scene had produced a record so clearly ambitious and, you know, confounding of ideas about what indie rock or emo really is. And I think that's why it came across, you know, it's been 3 years since they made a record too. So it's just been a long time since this sort of record has emerged from this scene, which is why it's taken so many people in the scene aback and why it surprised so many people who might not have heard them before.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
I mean, my sense with this album, because it, sonically offers so much more, I think, than a lot of bands from, you know, sort of the punk emo world where, you know, still you're in a situation where, you know, even like the really good bands from that scene, you know, they're not making, you know, prime time records necessarily. You know, they tend to make records that seem to have that sort of basement show aesthetic, you know, and that's not just true in that scene, but, you know, a lot of indie rock is kind of like that. And,
absolutely.
And the Foxing record, whether you love it or hate it, it's shooting for something, a kind of grandiosity that, you know, as you said before, it kind of only existed when bands had like million-dollar budgets to make records. I mean, I guess we've reached a point now with recording technology where if you're smart and you spend a lot of time, that you can make a record like this for, you know, a fraction of the cost, what it would have cost in the 90s or whatever. It's been interesting to see because I feel like this album has had more of an impact maybe than a lot of records from that scene. I see more people talking about it. It seems like there's more interest in Foxing. I mean, there's certainly been a good amount of press coverage, you know, and you and I have both tried to gin up our own amount of hype for this album, but, you know, other outlets as well have been talking about it. I don't know what this means for Foxing moving forward, but I mean, my sense is that the band has achieved to a degree what they set out to do with this album.
Well, I think what they set out to do, and I mean, I've interviewed just about all the bands from this scene, and for the most part, all of them are trying in some way to navigate that huge space that exists between, like, the thing about, like, emo now pretty much refers to like any sort of band that plays like emotional guitar music that exists outside of this like conglomerate of labels and PR companies that, like, for the most part are responsible for stocking festivals and like getting bands best new music and whatever. And it's like a lot of them wonder, it's like, dude, how do, like, we're indie rock. How do we get to play, you know, Coachella? Like, how do we get to like tour with Mitski or whatever, like those sort of things. And I think with them, like this record, as well as like Harmlessness and Goodness, like, or Never Hung Over Again by Joyce Manor, they all almost intentionally try to make that leap from this sort of emo world where the irony is these guys like turn on you if like you sound less emo. And then they're trying to get to this space where they can be taken seriously as like an indie rock band. And they, you know, they're seen maybe askance in that world as well because they come from that emo scene. And I can't see any band, like, I haven't seen too many bands actually navigate it, with maybe the exception of like JSOM, she started out on Top Shelf, and now she's, you know, in that indie mainstream world. But, you know, their intention, I think, for this one is to, and I think Hotelier said this with goodness as well, is to be taken seriously as, like, art rock, and to get in the same, you know, spoken in the same terms as, like, maybe TV on the Radio, which a lot of people have brought up, or that, rather than saying, oh, you'll be surprised, they don't sound like Taking Back Sunday.
right.
And no, like, even to this day, like, I've read the, like, some reviews of, like, Near My God, where it's like, I know it's emo, but, like, here's the thing, kids, it doesn't sound like My Chemical Romance. Or actually, I mean, that's not necessarily true. I mean, like, the Black Parade is, like, still, like, one of those big time ambitious records. But I think with this, like, and the one thing that makes this record so emotionally resonant for me, they put it right in there where they're like, man, we kind of want to be big. I mean, the title track, maybe not big, but it's like, get some approval for doing this stuff. Like, because you play like a band like Fox, like show after show after show every night. They wrote about this on Dealer as well, where it's like, is this worth it? You know, like, is this worth, like, my 20s and, like, not having any stability and and not making any money and so forth? And, you know, like, we're creating great art and it's rewarding, but especially now in the current state of things where it's much harder for a band to, like, be financially sustainable, it's like, I mean, I don't think they did it in a cynical way where they're trying to, like, be on a car commercial, but, like, there's just such this yearning for recognition and for validation. And, but in a way that, like, it to me is, like, relatable. I mean, even when I write about this stuff, it's like, you write about emo bands and it's like, you don't get the same sort of, like, you know, praise on Twitter about, like, you know, like, this groundbreaking work. It's like, for the most part, a lot of this stuff is done in obscurity and read by, like, a very small number of people. And Near My God, it has this ambition, this, like, this desire to, you know, just transcend the mundanity of life that I think speaks across all, you know, it's like, in the same way that, like, Mitski has a kind of persona that's relatable. Maybe Fox's thing is a little more, like, theirs is a little more embarrassing and, like, you know, adolescent, in the same way that Death Cab is, like, just being, I don't know, confused by your place in the world and, like, wondering, you know, if there really is more out there for you. And I think they just put it all in a record that just demands to be noticed in a way that I think is so rare in indie rock these days. You know, like, people who criticize it say, oh, it sounds like Portugal the Man or Passion Pit or whatever. It's like, yeah, but those are popular bands. It's like, you know, why is that objectively a worse thing than, like, being some band that wants to sound like the 50 billionth band to sound like Dinosaur Jr. or, like,
right,
you know, Built to Spill or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm into it, man. I think it's a great record. I think it's finding an audience. And, you know, we're not doing it for the Twitter likes. We're doing it for the long-term glory, man. We're doing it for the 10 years from now. That's what I'm talking about. So so to recap here, we talked about Interpol. I'm yay. You're kind of leaning towards nay. Death Cab for Cutie, you're yay. I'm leaning towards nay.
I think I'm more towards the middle on both.
Well,
of those,
you know, we're being reductive here. You know, we're being somewhat reductive. Mitski, we're both yay, and Foxing, we're both yay. So, like, on the new people, we're both
Foxing,
on the same page.
Fuck yeah.
You're a fuck yeah on Foxing, and I'll give him a fuck yeah too. I'll give a fuck yeah on Mitski too.
Yeah,
and Interpol, I'll give a yeah, and Death Cab, I'm like, oh, it's fine. So that's the reductive conclusions on those records. Ian, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I'm sure we'll be back again.
Yes.
Next time there's like four
fun
records to talk about. So thank you again, dude. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, man. Later.
All right, take care. All right, that was me and Ian getting into it. Always fun. Always fun to see Ian get worked up about emo. You know, getting worked up about Death Cab for Cutie and about Foxing. I admire his passion. He's storming the gates for emo. He's on that wall for all you emo kids out there. Got to give a shout out, as always, to Derek Madden, the man who makes it happen. Thank you, Derek. Got to give a shout out to Josh Copperman, the man who wrote our theme song. Thank you, Josh. And of course, thank you to all of our Celebration Rock listeners. Without you, we would not have a show. So thank you for your support. Thank you for talking about us on social media and for leaving nice reviews of us on iTunes. I read all of your reviews, and all of the nice ones make me feel really good, and all of the bad ones make me feel really sad. But fortunately, they're mostly good, so that's really great. Guys, thank you again for checking us out. We will be back with more Celebration Rock next week.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast, part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.